You have the right to lead a faith-based existence.
This case is not about her right to pray.
I'm Glenn Moberg. The guilty verdicts in the so-called prayer death trials are being appealed as the state legislature considers new laws that would restrict the rights of parents to practice faith healing. This Thursday, Route 51 welcomes Sean Peters, author of When Prayer Fails, as well as Dale Newman's former defense attorney, Jay Cronenwetter, and prosecutor Lamont Jacobson. We'll be taking your phone calls Thursday at 5 on the Ideas Network. Jay Cronenwetter is here in our studio. Sean Peters is hooked up by what we call an ISDN connection, so we have super clear sound with him at our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Madison. We will be joined by Lamont Jacobson, the Marathon County Assistant District Attorney, at the bottom of the hour.
Many people are looking at today as the end of this case. It's not the end of the case. This is the beginning of the case.
That was the voice of Jean Linehan, former defense attorney for Leilani Newman, following her conviction and sentencing, and the conviction and sentencing of her husband, Dale, for reckless homicide in the death of their 11-year-old daughter, Madeline Kara. In Linehan's words, this was just the beginning, as convictions are appealed to the state Supreme Court, and as two competing bills regarding faith healing make their way through the Wisconsin state legislature. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Route 51. The Newmans, convicted in Marathon County last summer for praying as their daughter died from treatable diabetes instead of calling a doctor or seeking medical attention. In bringing the case, prosecutors had to deal with two competing Wisconsin state laws, one which made parents responsible for the well-being of their children, and another which made faith healing or treatment by prayer permissible. Today we're going to look at the legal issues involved in Wisconsin's current law and the two proposals to change it in light of the Newman convictions. You will see that their trials were not unique, but that the arguments presented by both sides and the statements by the judge have been made over and over again in many courtrooms in many states all across America in similar cases that go back more than 100 years. Our guest today, joining us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Madison, Sean Francis Peters, the author of When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing, Children, and the Law. And here in our studio in Wausau, attorney Jay Cronenwetter, who represented Dale Newman during his criminal trial. Joining us in the second half of our program, the man who successfully prosecuted the Newmans, Assistant District Attorney Lamont Jacobson. As always, we're taking your phone calls. If you have questions or you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 261-6371. That's 261-6371. If you're in the Wausau area or anywhere you're listening, toll free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Sean Peters, Jay Cronenwetter and I both have something we agree on. We think you've written a very good book.
Well, thank you very much. It's always good to hear praise rather than criticism. So thank you very much.
The tension between two principles, the right of parents to practice their religion and the duty of parents to take care of their kids, this has been the subject of court cases going all the way back to the 1870s in this country and before that in England.
Absolutely. One of the things that I find interesting about the Newman case is that it's not new at all. And my book came out in 2007, at the end of 2007, and it just recounted literally hundreds of cases that are similar to that involving the Newmans, where we had parents prosecuted criminally for engaging in spiritual healing rituals that sort of went wrong. And so for me, looking at the case, the Newman case, it really echoed this pattern that I had sort of charted in cases going, as you mentioned, all the way, cases going back all the way to the mid-19th century.
Sean, how do you think the Newman trials and their convictions are reflected in these bills that are pending in the state legislature?
Well, clearly the impetus for these bills is the Newman case. I mean, it's both implicitly and explicitly. We know that the ambiguity in state law has motivated members of both chambers to move forward with bills that purport to clarify that ambiguity. They claim that they will clear it up. Whether either or both of those bills actually does it is another matter entirely. But we know that the Newman case clearly served as the spark for those two measures.
Jay, these convictions are being appealed. Now, we know you're not directly involved with representing either of the Newmans now that the criminal phase of the trials have ended. But as Dale's former defense attorney, what do you think will be the basis of his appeal?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, the religious issues, the issue over whether or not parents have a right to practice their religious beliefs when those beliefs deter them from seeking medical care for their children, I don't think that that sort of religious freedom right issue is going to be predominant in the appeal. Rather, the appeal focuses more on the duty of the state to clearly define criminal activity before they prosecute and punish someone for engaging in a course of conduct. And I think really that's going to be the central issue on appeal.
And that's that ambiguity in state law that that we've been talking about. The law school at UW-Madison has come forward to help with the appeals. Your reaction to that?
Well, I think it certainly highlights the importance of this case, that the appellate clinic, which really has its choice of many, many cases each year, decided to take it. I also think that it points to the strength of the Newman's case. I think that the criminal appeals clinic would not have invested the type of time and energy into the case if they didn't see a real chance for success.
I don't want to relitigate this case here today, but I am going to revisit it briefly. We're going to listen to some comments that were made by Prosecutor Lamont Jacobson, who will be joining us at the bottom of the hour, regarding the condition of Kara prior to her death, and we'll follow that with a statement by her father, Dale Newman, that was made on the witness stand this past July.
By then, Kara hadn't had solid food since Friday night. She hadn't been able to walk since she fell in the bathroom. She was unconscious and unresponsive. Later Sunday morning, the defendant finds that Kara urinated herself, not because he went to check on her, but because he tried to prop her up to pray for her. But rather than to call for help, the defendant picks up his daughter, limp, unresponsive, covered in urine, and carries her up to the bathroom for a sponge bath. Kara's become nothing more than a big rag doll.
That was Prosecutor Lamont Jacobson. Now let's listen to the comments by Kara's father, Dale Newman, on the witness stand this past summer.
Dale R. Newman is dead, but Jesus Christ is within me. And the life I now live, I live by the faith of the Son of God. But I found myself actually questioning whether there is a God. And so I called out in desperation, God, if there is a God, show me a better way. And I remember as he's speaking, I'm bending over and crouching over and crying out in agony and pain. I said, God, we're so blind! And if you read the Gospels and you read the epistles, any mention that Jesus had, he never went to a doctor, ever.
She is with the Lord, and she lives forever in his presence.
Those were five different clips of Dale Newman at different points during his testimony, and that last clip was made just prior to his sentencing. Dale testified on his own behalf. Lalani did not. Now, it took 15 hours to get a conviction for Dale. Clearly, the jury was troubled, and one of the things you said to the court is that Dale Newman, regardless of what you think of him, is not a phony. He really believes in the power of prayer.
Well, absolutely. I think anyone who was in that courtroom the day Dale testified would have seen that. I think anyone who meets Dale on the street will see that. I don't think the honesty of his faith was really questioned even by the prosecution.
And Sean, as jarring and as riveting as Dale Newman's testimony may have been to some people, and I imagine to some people who are just listening, it was not unusual. There have been case after case in which parents were similarly unapologetic, you could even say unrepentant, in very similar faith healing cases all across the country going back 100 years.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you could have played a tape of that and asked me if it was any number of different cases over the years. I mean, the way he described his motivations for acting and his response, that's all very consistent with other parents who've been charged in similar cases too. And to go back to what Jay just said, I agree absolutely. In terms of, it's not a question of sincerity at all. One can question, and I think, I imagine some callers will, can question the rationality of it and so forth. But in terms of, is this something that parents like Dale honestly believe? The question is absolutely yes. Again and again, we see parents really genuinely believing what they state. They don't sort of concoct this as a Hail Mary defense to get out of criminal prosecution. It is something that they really, truly believe.
261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Our guest, Sean Peters, the author of When Prayer Fails, and Jay Cronenwetter, former defense attorney for Dale Newman. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jim in Rhinelander. Jim, you're on Route 51. Hello, Jim.
Hi. I'm thinking that if the couple wins their appeal, the only reason they should win this is because of mental insanity. And the other thing is, I think we should get rid of any laws that would allow people to allow their children to die in front of their eyes because they've got some religious belief that, you know, by praying they're going to be healed. You know what? All of our prayers have been answered already. We have doctors that know what these problems are and how to fix them. I mean, I can't believe that this even happens, that people like this would even be protected. I can't think of a religion that within their religious guidelines would think abortion was a good thing, that the society would stand for such a thing like that. Well, abortion is a religious belief of ours, therefore that should be allowed.
Without commenting on the comments you just made on abortion, if we can bring it back to the Newman case, first of all, there is a law pending, Jim, in the state legislature, which is designed to do exactly that, eliminate the exemption for faith healing. And Jay Cronenwetter, you never broached the subject of using an insanity defense with your client, Dale Newman.
Well, no. I mean, he clearly does not have a mental disease or defect that would.
He clearly does.
Let's let Jay comment, and then I'll give you another chance, Jim.
Well, I guess this highlights the public's misunderstanding of law quite well, I think. Mental disease and defect is clearly defined in law, and an attorney who knows that definition would not for a second imagine Dale Newman to be legally mentally deficient in that way. You may think that his behavior, the caller, Jim, obviously believes that his behavior was irrational. The jury, to some extent, agreed with that in finding him guilty. It was unreasonable by the legal definition, but certainly not a mental disease or defect that could be diagnosed and address his criminal culpability.
Jim, we'll give you a follow-up.
Well, I guess I disagree with that, and, you know, I'm glad that they're going to look at repealing these sort of laws. And like I said, people's prayers have been answered. They're called doctors. Okay, so you don't need to pray at the bedside while your child is dying and suffering and misery and pain for days or weeks on end. It's just totally ridiculous, and you can put all the lawyer or legal ease and spin on it, but, morally, it's very lacking.
Jim, thanks so much for the phone call. And what's interesting is that comment that the prayers have been answered with doctors and with modern medicine. Sean Peters, that was not only a comment that was made by Judge Howard during the sentencing, but if I'm not mistaken, it's a comment that was made by other judges in other cases in other courts.
Sure. But this is such a, as both of you have highlighted, I mean, this is not only a complicated legal issue, it's absolutely a complex moral and ethical issue. And these questions about how do we affect physical healing and what is the relationship between, you know, doctors and divine power and so forth. I mean, we've grappled with these for a long time, and we're still, many of us are still working that out. I think if you asked most mainstream Christians in the United States, they would say that they sort of believe in both. They believe in the power of prayer as a complement to medical science. And what we have with individuals like Dale and Leilani is people who don't believe in prayer as a complement. They just they believe in that power of prayer to the exclusion of all else. And so it's not like completely anomalous, the belief in that prayer heals. Most people actually believe that. It's the belief that nothing else but prayer.
That is an interesting statistic. That was at the Center for Disease Control that took that poll, indicating that most Americans have prayed at one time or another for health or for the health of a loved one.
Sure, absolutely. And the difference is they will be at the hospital praying as opposed to being in the home with the church elders or whomever.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Bill in Rothschild. Bill, you're on Route 51. Hello, Bill.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm somewhat familiar with the case and was just curious if the Newman parents had ever gone to an eye doctor, had dental work done, taken aspirin, antacids, etc., to cure an ailment or feeling ill. If they have, then their whole case or the way they treated their daughter is inaccurate.
Well, there was testimony in court that Leilani had asked for an aspirin at one time. Jay, you'd probably be better commenting on this, though.
Certainly. This was something that came up at trial, and both Dale and Leilani have been to the doctor. In fact, the children had also been to the doctor. It was not until some years after the birth of their last child that both parents came to a new understanding, a new religious belief from what they had been raised in. And really, it was a later acquired belief system.
Okay, so to this date, then, they don't use a doctor anymore or a dentist for anything? Or
That is correct. They do not use medical services. Their children, under court order now, do get quarterly checkups from from a licensed physician.
Yeah, thank God. Okay.
All right, Bill,
thanks.
Thanks so much for the phone call, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Defense attorney Jay Cronenwetter and author Sean Peters were talking about the legal fallout from the Newman trials and the legislation that's pending in Madison. We'll be back after this short break.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
We're talking about the fallout from the Newman trial and the legislation that's pending in Madison. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51. We've got former Newman defense attorney Jay Cronenwetter with us, and also author Sean Peters. Prosecutor Lamont Jacobson will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. Let's listen to the comments of defense attorney Gene Linehan. These were made at the sentencing hearing, and they kind of set the pace or set the tone for what would follow.
But philosophically, you have the right, the absolute right, to lead a faith-based existence. My client has been charged with homicide because she has faith in her Creator, ultimate faith. My client has been prosecuted in Marathon County, Wisconsin, and people are saying, well, this will set a precedent for the state, maybe for the nation. No, it won't. This has to go up to the state legislature. It has to go to the Supreme Court so that we get a statewide standard that is in writing before the situation occurs. And that might be, yes, you can rely upon faith-based medicine, but if you have children, then you have to take an additional step. That notice is not there, and it's got to be there. And they're perfectly willing to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to give to Jesus what is Jesus's. But you have to understand what Caesar's asking for.
That's actually one of my favorite quotes from the trial. Willing to give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to Jesus what is Jesus, but you have to understand what Caesar is asking for. And Sean Peters, those pending or proposed laws in Madison are intended to do exactly that.
Absolutely, and I think that that's an excellent way of putting it, and Jay has highlighted this earlier, that state law is confusing, and we can talk about how and when it should be clarified. But as it stands now, we still have a provision in state law that appears to protect treatment through prayer. It's in Chapter 948, which outlines crimes against children in our state code. And that is the legal argument that is going to be sort of explored on appeal, is just how clear state law actually is. I happen to think, and I said even before this case was brought to trial, that that would be the ultimate legal question. And these competing laws now aim to sort of rectify that in two very different ways.
We don't have time to get to that before the news break.
Okay.
So we'll get to that after the news break. We do have time to get to a phone call, though. Let's go to Ed in Wausau. Ed, you're on Route 51.
Hi. I just wondering if sanity was ever taken into account. I was involved with a divorce situation when my ex, I had moved out of the house, took off with my kid against court order, had to hire detectives in three different states, track her down. Coincidentally, Vince Howard was the guardian ad litem for my kid.
Let's, Ed, let's try to stay on the Newman case and the state law.
No, it's related.
Because, well, very quickly, we've got a news break coming up.
Can you catch me after the break?
Try to conclude your thought right now.
I can't conclude my thing, because when you're talking about a legal thing, I have to. It's going to take me longer than just before the break.
Well,
should I just hang up?
Well, the question about sanity, Jay Cronenwetter, I believe that was addressed by you from an earlier caller. You did not follow through with the idea that maybe the Newmans should have taken an insanity defense.
Yes. For your benefit, Ed, I don't think that either of them had a mental disease or defect that would meet the state law requirement to prevent legal responsibility for their actions.
Very good. We are talking to Jay Cronenwetter, Dale Newman's former defense attorney, Sean Peters, the author of When Prayer Fails. We're talking about the legal fallout from the Newman trial, two laws that are pending in the state legislature that would change Wisconsin state law on the faith exemption. Prosecutor, Marathon County Assistant District Attorney, Lamont Jacobson will join us after this break.
Fox Cities Book Festival, April 11th through the 18th. The Fox Cities Book Festival features nearly 50 authors at a variety of Appleton area venues. Information at travelwisconsin.com, keyword Fox Cities Book Festival.
We're back on Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the fallout from the Newman trials, their sentencing, their convictions, their appeals, and now two laws that are making their way through the state legislature regarding the statewide exemption for faith healing in the state's child abuse standards. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guests, Sean Peters. He is the author of a book called When Prayer Fails, a history of this tension that exists between religious freedom and the duties of parents to protect their children. He's joining us from our studio in Madison. Here in our studio in Wausau, we have Jay Cronenwetter, Dale Newman's former defense attorney, and joining us by telephone, Lamont Jacobson, Marathon County Assistant District Attorney, who was instrumental in securing the convictions of Dale and Leilani Newman last summer. Lamont Jacobson, your perspective on these bills that are wending their way through the state legislature.
Well, there are two bills. There's the Brousseau bill that's been introduced. That would eliminate the religious exception. And then there's the Taylor bill that basically takes a faith-based or creates a faith-based affirmative defense.
And it's Lena Taylor in the state Senate, and is it Teresa Brousseau in the Assembly? Two very different perspectives on how to deal with this issue. Lamont Jacobson, your perspective on which way the state should be going.
Well, I favor the Brousseau bill that would take away the religious exception. I've always maintained that the religious beliefs that someone have certainly is going to be considered at trial in cases such as these, because you always have to establish that the person had an awareness or knowledge of the risk that they were involved in. So really adding the affirmative defense that Senator Taylor suggests really complicates things a lot, and really a lot of what her bill calls for is going to be addressed at a trial of any faith-based case.
Now, Sean Peters, I understand it, the Brousseau bill in the Assembly simply removes the exemption that's in state law right now for faith healing, while there are like nine different provisions that are being inserted in the bill that Lena Taylor is pushing in the state Senate.
You've described it correctly. The Brousseau bill just takes out the treatment through prayer exemption, and that's it. The Taylor bill takes it out, but then adds a kind of laundry list of affirmative defenses. And I think Lamont is exactly right. If the Taylor bill becomes law, I don't know if you're somebody who believes that these cases should be successfully prosecuted. I don't know how that would really happen under the Taylor bill. It would be really difficult for a jury to find one. If you believe that these parents should be found guilty, it would be really hard to do, I think, if the Taylor bill became law.
Well, Jay Cronenwetter, you obviously didn't believe that the parents should be found guilty. Where do you come down on this issue?
Well, to be honest, I have reviewed the bills. I'm not certain that either bill would appropriately close the door on this type of dispute and discussion coming up again. Certainly, however, I don't think that our current legal structure provides defendants the right to defend themselves in the way that Lena Taylor's bill would, for example. At Dale Newman's trial, very significantly, one of the first questions that the jury asked us is, was Dale Newman's faith a defense? How does that affect the defense? And unfortunately, we didn't really have a good answer for that jury, I don't think. Because the law just simply isn't clear on how honest faith plays a role in the defense.
The Senate bill that's being pushed by Lena Taylor, there were 18 people who spoke in favor of it at a Senate hearing. All of them identified themselves as Christian Scientists. Sean Peters, what does that say to you?
The Christian Science Church is behind that law. They've worked closely with Lena Taylor to craft its provisions. And, they have a right to do so. We live in a political culture where interest groups of all varieties can come forth and try to influence legislation in their favor. But it was interesting, the numbers were sort of reversed for the public hearings on the Brousseau bill. When the Brousseau bill was, when there were public hearings, the Christian Scientists were the only group to speak against that bill, and you had a number of law enforcement, social work, and child welfare organizations speaking in favor of the Brousseau bill, which would just simply remove the exemption. And I think that speaks to who is supporting what, basically, in our public discourse.
Sean, the Christian Science Church has really been instrumental in getting these faith healing exemptions put into a lot of state laws, according to what I read in your book, and they were also very powerful 100 years ago, challenging some of the first attempts at prosecution in child abuse or child neglect or child death cases, and even taking on the American Medical Association, which wanted only licensed physicians to be allowed to perform medical care.
Sure. The Christian Scientists, again, as is their right in our democracy, they've been at the forefront of crafting these laws and sort of zealously trying to influence public policy. We've talked about this treatment through prayer exemption that's in Chapter 948. They wrote it. I mean, the Christian Scientists literally, I mean, there's, I found the correspondence for, through the Legislative Reference Bureau. They wrote that provision of state law word for word, and they got members of the legislature to introduce it. And again, there's nothing illegal or unethical about that, but I think it's important to just realize where it came from. And it's just important to have a broad public discussion. I think that the Christian Scientists have a right to participate in our political process, but so should other people too. We should have a number of stakeholders sort of discussing how we want our public policy to develop.
Lamont Jacobson, how do you respond to people who say there's a First Amendment to the Constitution, it guarantees religious freedom? Parents traditionally throughout history have had wide latitude in the way they raise their children and punish their children and take care of their children. You as a prosecutor are simply out of bounds by trying to file criminal cases against parents like the Newmans, who have a right to use prayer under the state constitution.
Well, there's the balancing act. There's no question about it. But certainly, when the state feels that a child's endangered, it's my position that the state should step in and protect that child. I mean, this is an extreme case, no doubt about it, and it factors in religion, which oftentimes isn't there. But it's not much different than the decision we have to make with a child neglect case. Like, how old should children be when they stay at home alone? You know, how long do you leave a child in a car on a warm summer's day? It's not unusual for the state to step in and protect children under the belief that children can't protect themselves and sometimes need to be protected.
The whole history of the whole human history, children have often been abused, you know, going back to antiquity. Back in Roman times, Sean Peters, you write that children basically were the property of their fathers. They could be sold. They could be mutilated. And it was only really within the last 200 years or so that we started to establish within our law provisions that protected children from their own parents when that was necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that children were sort of legal people who deserved state protection is relatively new, and that's why we've only seen cases like this really within the last 150 years or so. And that's as the state has taken on a greater role in protecting children. We've seen prosecutors and child welfare organizations they've shown a greater willingness to sort of interpose themselves between parents and children. And that's a tough decision to make, but it's a decision that's made in the eyes of prosecutors and other people in the best interests of children. You have to puncture that relationship when the relationship endangers the child.
We've got one final tape that I'm going to play here, and I'd like both attorneys and you, Sean, to give your reaction to it. These are comments that Judge Vincent Howard made during his sentencing of Dale Newman.
While parents may be free to become martyrs themselves, it does not follow that they are free in identical circumstances to make martyrs of their children. We are here today because to some, you made Kara a martyr for your faith. While you clearly did not wish to see Kara die, you both watched as she became weaker, lost the ability to stand, walk, talk, to eat, and eventually lapsed into unconsciousness. Now, what is really involved here is a flawed but certainly reckless exercise of judgment due to your religious beliefs. In this nation, the sanctity of your religious beliefs is protected by the constitutional guarantee. But what is overlooked and overlooked by you, that the guarantee is a limited one. It protects religious belief, but not religious conduct and practices.
Those comments, you cannot be a martyr. Kara is the martyr. Parents are not free to make their children die for their religious beliefs. And again, Sean Peters, I was struck by seeing almost identical language used in other cases in other places by other judges.
Sure, that quote about making martyrs of your children comes from a United States Supreme Court case, Prince versus Massachusetts. It's quoted almost every single one of these cases at some point. Someone will quote that. And I think the judge in terms of his summarizing the sort of limits or boundaries of religious behavior, I think that that's a very accurate summary of the way we treat religious conduct. Yes, we believe in protecting religious freedom and religious exercise. However, we put boundaries on that. And in the eyes of the jury, the Newman's conduct exceeded those boundaries.
And the other reference was to the case Reynolds versus the United States, in which he said that there's a difference between religious conduct and religious practice and religious belief.
Sure, absolutely.
Religious belief is protected, but conduct isn't.
Exactly. And Reynolds is a case from the it's from 1879 that deals with polygamy, which is another it's sort of the classic American example of the boundaries we put on religious conduct. You can't do anything you want in the name of religion. And so that belief conduct distinction is one way of thinking about it. You can believe lots of stuff, but you can't take actions that harm others in the name of religion. And that's we try to work that out in these cases.
Now the Newmans could have gotten 25 years. Instead, they got 6 months, served 30 days at a time until Kara would have turned 18. We have a long history of judges handing down light sentences after convictions in these kinds of cases. Lamont Jacobson, I'd like you to comment on that. Do you think Judge Howard was too lenient?
Well, it's difficult to know what to do in any case that's a reckless homicide, because no one is claiming that the result that occurred was desired by the defendant. And you have to factor in things such as their belief, the circumstances. I asked for a year in jail as a condition of probation. Judge Howard gave 6 months. It's not that far off, given the mitigating factors that were present in this case. You had people who were, you know, good citizens, upstanding citizens, who had a strong religious belief, who let their daughter die. It's a balancing test.
But if they let their daughter die, why in the world, if they're that dangerous in this one case, would you allow them to keep their other children?
And that's why there's the monitoring that Jay mentioned in the first half hour. The children are having medical checkups. Those are ongoing, and they will continue until they reach adulthood and can make their own decisions.
And Jay Cronin, what are your reaction to the sentence that Judge Howard handed down last October?
Well, I think the sentence that Judge Howard gave perhaps reflects the reality of his assessment of their culpability more than some of the rhetoric that was tossed their way. You know, a 6-month sentence for a homicide clearly indicates that the judge did not feel that they were terribly culpable, despite the conviction.
2616371 or 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're talking about the legal fallout from the Newman convictions, the appeals, but also the two laws, proposed laws that are making their way through the state legislature. We have Marathon County Assistant District Attorney Lamont Jacobson, Dale Newman's former defense attorney, Jay Cronenwetter, and author Sean Peters. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're talking about faith healing and the law, specifically a couple of laws, pending, possible laws that are pending in Madison. Let's go to the phones. We've got Mary in Plainfield. Hello, Mary. You're on Route 51.
Hi. I just wanted to, you know, make an observation that people could say that children are inherently evil and that they, because of their religious beliefs, they need to beat the devil out of them, and that would not be condoned. And this is very similar to that, I think. They weren't violent, but it is a sort of violence. It's a violence because of negligence.
Actually, Mary, there was another case in Milwaukee. This is back in August of 2003, a 4-year-old Milwaukee boy with autism named Terrence Cottrell Jr. Am I pronouncing that right, Sean?
I say it as Cottrell, yeah,
Cottrell,
but that's the right case.
And he died after a series of attempted exorcisms
he was
beaten, and he actually ended up suffocating when the pastor kneeled on him until he stopped breathing.
Yep.
And so I guess, Jay Cronenwetter, how would you distinguish between this case with Dale Newman allowing his 11-year-old daughter to die a very painful death right in front of his eyes, and a case where a 4-year-old boy with autism is being beaten in order to drive the devil out? Mary doesn't think there's any difference.
Oh, can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
The other thing is that because they have been used to allopathic medicine in the past and had taken pain relievers or whatever in the past, they had knowledge of the fact that that child could have been saved. That's the other thing. They knew that there was options for saving her life.
All right. Mary, thanks so much for the phone call.
I'll
and Jay, I'd like you to tell me why Dale Newman's case was different than this case in Milwaukee.
Certainly. I think, first of all, it's important to remember that Kara was noticeably sick to her parents for just a short time before she died. I know a lot of things were out in the media about months, etc., of illness. And also, I have to dispute the characterization of Kara's passing as a very painful death. In fact, there was no testimony from anyone that Kara ever complained of pain. She complained of tiredness and weakness. But never any indication of complaining of pain. I think the difference here is that you have parents who wanted to cause absolutely no harm to their child, wanted to do what they thought would heal her, in fact, and they were taking efforts to heal her, none of which would cause physical pain, such as beating or you know, suffocating someone, doing things that we all know causes harm to someone.
Well, she wasn't experiencing pain toward the end there because she was in a coma. She was unconscious.
Indeed, she was unconscious for the last few hours, the last day of her life, and that is certainly the case. However, you know, someone being unconscious may say different things to different people. The Newmans, whether this was an error in judgment or not, I believe that they testified that they thought she was at rest in what they thought was a deep sleep.
And didn't it also come up during the trial that the Newmans thought that physical illness was caused by sin? So, of course, if Kara was feeling pain, she wouldn't talk to her parents about that because they'd think she was sinning.
Well, the notion of the relation between sin and sickness in various evangelical and Pentecostal communities is relatively complex. I'm sure we don't have the time to go through it today, but our sort of secular use of sickness and sin being related, I think the testimony at trial certainly indicated that it's not quite the correlation that probably jumps to the secular mind.
Okay. Lamont Jacobson, I'll let you weigh in on this. I think I already made two of your arguments, though, and at least the arguments that were made during the trial.
Well, yeah, and I think that there was evidence in the trial that she would have been suffering. I believe Dr. Zador testified to that. So that there was some evidence there, and certainly she was unable to speak for 24 hours. So to say that she wasn't encountering pain, I think that's wrong.
Let's go back to the phone. To the phones. We have time for one more call. We'll get Bob in Park Falls. Hello, Bob. You're on Route 51.
Hello. Hope everybody's having a good day. Good evening. But I've been watching this case real close. I'm a native of Wausau, and I'm not a really religious person, but I do believe in the power of prayer as far as healing. And what I see happening with prosecuting Newmans is, what's the next step the state's going to take? Are they going to be showing up at my daughter's wedding? A couple of years ago, a Lutheran pastor offered my grandson, who was 6 years old at the time, communion. I don't feel he should have offered communion, but he did offer communion, and my grandson took it. That was wine. Is the DA going to be coming after me and or the pastor for offering my grandson communion? Because
Bob, it's a slippery slope argument,
and also, what's going to happen as far as my Jewish friends? If you're at a brisk, no anesthesia, they do a circumcision. My Chinese friends practicing their types of medicine.
What's next? What's next for other religions, and how will this lead to other problems, Sean Peters?
I wouldn't worry about it, really. I mean, we live in such a religious culture. We're the most religious Western culture. And the idea that you know, we're opening the floodgates to sort of state-sponsored religious persecution. I just do not see that happening. And look no further than these cases. I mean, we have cases here where children have died, which is a pretty serious result. And yet the prosecutions are very tentative often, and the punishments are somewhat muted. So I think it's a legitimate concern to, you know, question the power of the state. I'm all for that. But I know, I won't speak for Lamont, but they have plenty of other much more serious crimes to worry about.
Lamont, do you hope this legislation, the Brousseau bill, makes it through the House and Senate?
Yes, I definitely hope it does. I think it's necessary. It clears up an issue in these cases. And certainly, I agree with Jay. The anomaly that's present in this law does create an appealable issue, and I fully expect that to be addressed and welcome it being addressed by the courts.
Lamont Jacobson, thanks so much. Jay Cronenwetter, your view on the legislation pending in Madison?
Well, I think the state needs to clearly make up its mind one way or the other. Either we are protecting parents' use of faith healing, or we're refusing to.
Very good. Defense attorney for Dale Newman, Jay Cronenwetter, Sean Peters, author of When Prayer Fails, and Marathon County Assistant District Attorney Lamont Jacobson. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Mary Baldwin. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Thanks again for riding with us today. Until next week, we're heading out of town.